You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. I feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you cry? Yeah, we're gonna let it fly, guys.
The Goo Goo Dolls here.
Love the life you kill. The priest is on the phone. Your father hit the wall. Your mother don't you.
On your 50,000 watt music mother of the West Coast, All Marine Radio.
I live around here. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why do you die?
Joining us now is Andy Milburn, Colonel in the United States Marine Corps, retired, world traveler, MARSOC dude. And first of all, happy Thanksgiving, Andy.
Hey, to you too, Mac. All the best to you, man.
Yeah.
Great to hear your voice.
All right. Do you have any? The way you get back on All Marine Radio is you tell the truth and we deal with it later and you qualify. So I wanted to have you on to talk about, you know, the Secretary of the Navy resigned and I wasn't surprised given, you know, what I had read about what, the direction that thing was going. And so I wanted to have you on and to talk about it. But I wanted to say happy Thanksgiving because I wanted to do that, like, interpersonal piece before, right, we did the business piece. So happy Thanksgiving. Do you guys have big plans?
No, actually, we're going to stay at home. And you know, before we get into the topic you just brought up, there's so much to unpack there, and you know, we'll keep in our discussion between you and I, keep it on a nonpartisan level, so this isn't because the problem is the waters got so muddied between the Trumpers and the anti-Trumpers, and I want to keep this a kind of a clean discussion about the authority of the commander in chief and professional norms, et cetera, but before we get into that, and I appreciate you reaching out and saying happy Thanksgiving. You're always very good at least faking those those courtesies.
I can fake it with anybody, man. Don't kid yourself.
You certainly can, man. With the best of them. So Thanksgiving. You know, I don't want to, you know, keep banging on me being an immigrant thing, but Thanksgiving was it was not a holiday. I'd heard of it, obviously, but I'd never celebrated it until I was at boot camp, and we had a glorious day out in the field where they didn't yell at us. Well, you know, and we had a turkey meal, and I thought this is pretty cool. And very different than 4th of July, because subsequently as a PFC Lance Corporal and then as a second lieutenant, every 4th of July I got duty because I was a Brit, and they figured that was just kind of, you know, the continued theme of that holiday. But fast forward.
No, I think it's the coolest American holiday because it's about nothing other than, you know, hanging out with your family and people you love. It's about eating, which is near and dear to everybody. And so Thanksgiving's my favorite of all the holidays. To me, it's the best holiday for those reasons. And for those of us who've spent it around the world, I always appreciate it. I don't care where I was, the attempts that the American military makes to make it feel like, you know, bring a little bit of, you know, it's a pretty lonely day, especially if you can't call home. And a lot of times you can't. And, But, you know, it seems like almost everywhere you go, you get something made out of turkey and some mashed potatoes and gravy and cranberry. And so the American military goes to great lengths to try to bring a little bit of Thanksgiving wherever you are around the world. So I would be remiss if did not mention, it didn't matter where I was, Ramadi, Fallujah, Helmand, you know, Okinawa, Korea, you know, all the different places that I spent, you know, Thanksgiving when I wasn't with my family. The cooks, the bakers, and the candlestick makers, they moved mountains to try to get you food. And so hats off to them.
Yeah, if your readers haven't seen a New York Times article came out last week called Thanksgiving at War. You can Google it and I think, you know, you can get through the New York Times paywall. But it's a really good article, and actually not just because I'm featured in it, but in there is a paragraph about the really inarguably the best Thanksgiving I've ever had, to your point, and it was during the Battle of Fallujah. And you know, by the time we got to Thanksgiving, some of you guys will remember the battle had been going on almost 3 weeks, and the Iraqi government had declared the city secure, but it wasn't by any means secure. And I was an advisor at the time with the 5th Battalion Iraqi Army, and it was like going to war with Mrs. Moffat's third grade class, you know, and morphed with a Stephen King movie. It was just horrible. And but anyway, you know, so by the time Thanksgiving rolled around, we'd lost, unfortunately, had one advisor killed, several wounded. But we hunted down in a mosque. It was called Al Hydra Mosque, one of the few mosques left standing.
Right.
And Marines brought Thanksgiving dinner to us and to the Iraqi soldiers, by the way. You know, trawling through the streets that were still very dangerous in order to do that. And that was the first hot meal we'd had in almost 3 weeks. And it was the first time that we'd really had a chance to sit down and relax. And, you know, it just stands out in my memory. It was a brief respite between,
right,
you know, the horrors that had gone on before and the horrors that took place afterwards. But it was just a terrific day. And when anyone asked me, and I love all the things you mentioned. I love eating. I love being around the family. But that particular Thanksgiving was particularly special.
Now, you know, one thing that I remember from 2004 was we had some trucks get ambushed and burned. And one of the trucks, I can't remember where it was headed, but it had all the turkey shit in it. And it's like,
it's a war crime.
No, can you imagine the reaction? They did what?
Yeah.
They fucking blew up our turkey. Find them right now. Find them yesterday. Make them fucking pay. They fucked up our turkey. Are you kidding me?
That's our critical vulnerability, man. It cuts to the core of our values.
You could mess with our trucks. You could try to blow us up, and but you fuck with our turkey? Like, are you kidding me? No, I mean, true though. That was like, what? Anyway, I want to. So let's. And again, Andy, I have no interest in partisan. The partisan aspect of any of this, because to me, right, there's no difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, right? They both play fast and loose with the truth, right? They both make their money in American politics at the highest level, where money corrupts, in my opinion, absolutely. And so admit nothing, deny everything, make counter accusations, and on to the next event. That's how.
Yeah,
that's
no, this is.
That's how American politics work.
Yeah, we'll keep this to a discussion about, you know, presidential authority, and the theme really is, you know, the playoff here between commander in chief's authority, as I said, and professional norms, and just, you know, as a lead in. I ask everyone to remember that just because someone has a right to do something doesn't necessarily make it the right thing to do. But if you'll allow me, Mac, I'd like to just kind of begin at the beginning on the Gallagher case because unless you've had a specific program about this topic, I just want to go through some of the facts that have led us to this point.
Well, I have.
Are you good with that?
No, I have. Okay. No. But I want you to walk through it because I have my own perspective on this, and I just talked about it a little bit ago, right? You know, the fact that you're not found guilty doesn't mean you're exonerated or innocent, Okay.
Yeah, and this
and
so,
so
much
to me,
you're right.
Exactly. So when you unpack this thing, right, and the moral courage it took with inside the SEAL community to do what they were being told to do, which is we've got to get control of this thing, right? And these young SEALs go forward, and they get screwed in this whole thing. And now, to me, what we're watching play out is the arrogance of a culture, right? That is so, in my opinion, that is so lost its way that it is foisting this lie on the American people, right? And saying, yeah, this is the emperor's new clothes. So nod your head, tell him that he's got these great looking clothes on in spite of the fact that it's all a bunch of fucking bullshit. And that's why, to me, I applaud Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer. I don't know exactly what happened in the Who Shot John of all that. But he knew when he allowed this shit to go forward last week that his days were numbered. No doubt in my mind. And Admiral Green is next. His days are numbered,
yeah,
too. Right? And
yeah,
they knew that. So, but I'm going to back out of this. I want you to unpack this for us because I want this to be about your perspective, not mine.
Okay. So to kick off, I'm going to quote from the SEAL code. And, there's a line in there that says, that where they promise to serve with honor, and with integrity on and off the battlefield. And that is, you know, that is the, yes, they go through buds, but that code is also their claim to the trident. So what this latest issue is about, as your listeners know, taking away that trident, which is Admiral Green's prerogative as head of NSW. And of course it is the prerogative of, you know, anyone over him to, you know, to counteract that. All understood. Gallagher, you know, he did go through a trial. As you're probably aware, the trial was just shambolic. Between NCIS and the JAG, they created an absolute dog's breakfast of the trial. So in the end, he was only indicted for the photograph with right. the prisoner missing. But there's a lot of stuff, a lot of churn that went on that everyone knew about within the NSW community, behind the scenes of the trial, that has left a bad taste in everyone's mouth. So Cass, you know, just to kind of begin with the beginning, but I'm going to breeze through it fairly quickly, some of the details of the case. So back in 2017, when the siege of Sodaf, Iraq, was supporting Iraqi soldiers closing in on Mosul, a teenage prisoner fell into the hands of coalition forces, specifically SEAL Team 7, the trident which Gallagher was at the time. During the course of some 20 minutes over which, you know, various accounts diverge, that prisoner was subjected either to experimentation or medical help, depending on, you know, how you view it, before Gallagher allegedly cut the prisoner's throat and then they posed for photographs. So what emerged during the trial, and this or actually in the lead up to the trial, was the experimentation piece. You know, it seemed ostensibly as though here were guys trying to do the right thing. But then it turns out that witnesses, you know, when the prisoner died, he had all these contraptions stuck in him. You know, they were, it wasn't a single method to try and save his life. He had stuff stuck in his throat and his lungs, and it looked as though that they were kind of using him as a life-for-life tissue training, and some of the witnesses testified to that effect. For some reason, the prosecution botched all of this, tried to suppress that particular evidence, and this all came out in a Navy Times article. And then, as you know, there's so many other things that went wrong with that trial that it's not even worth going through. But to the point you made earlier, the sad part about it was that some of those SEALs involved in this episode knew what was happening was wrong, and also had been discussed by Gallagher's actions earlier during the battle for Mosul, when he allegedly shot at civilians to the point where, again, allegedly his own guys played with his weapon, his sights, to throw them off so that, you know, in the hope that he would miss something. So this is
an extraordinary story.
And,
right. And others, Andy said, I shot more rounds to warn people, so he wouldn't murder them, than I did at bad guys. Now that's testimony.
Yep. And then, as you know, things come out in the trial, but then there's things that come out within the community, that become, well known and, you know, that don't make the news. And so while all this stuff was making the news, it became evident that SEAL Team 7 had gone completely feral. And, by the way, this is the unit that some 18 months later, was sent home from Iraq, a platoon from, you know, SEAL Team 7. My good friend Chris Brown, who's a Commodore of Group 1, who's just he's an awesome officer, is, you know, in the last couple of weeks has had to plow through, you know, a couple of dozen captain's mass members of that platoon. They were sent home anyway for drinking and, as you know, alleged sexual assault. So, you know, this plays into everything that you and I have talked about before on this program about culture, you know, and when culture starts going downhill, you look at the leadership within that unit. And Gallagher, by all accounts, had kind of led this downward slide within the culture. And there were things going on that some of which have made the news, where he was threatening witnesses, he was making fun of witnesses, he was referring to his chain of command as, quote, fucking morons, you know, publicly. Even if he was absolutely innocent of the charges at hand, and he wasn't, by the way, he was still, you know, cited for posing for photographs with a prisoner that you and I know is a big deal,
right.
Despite what I've heard from various so-called experts saying it isn't. So the things that would have justified his relief, his demotion, going up on captain's mast. But the problem is, when you've court-martialed someone, to then send them up on captain's mast on lesser charges, it is, you know, you any lawyer will tell you that you're going to run into perception problems. But getting back to the way of evidence of all the stuff that Gallagher had done, the way he treated his fellow SEALs, treated subordinates, not just civilians, the way that he had undermined his leadership, just a thug and a bully, that led to the decision by Admiral Greene to say, hey, we're going to take his trident, based on the fact that Sir Gallagher had not served with honor and integrity on or off the battlefield. That's, you know, that just seems cut and dried. And so people get confused by this. You know, they think, oh, it's, you know, it's just sour grapes. They're trying to railroad this war hero. And I'm so tired of hearing that term applied loosely to Gallagher. And that is, you know, as you and I know, that's kind of the insidious, undertone that supports actions like Gallagher. And we haven't even mentioned Lawrence and Goldstein. You know, we can get to them, but, you know, there's,
right.
But you know, that subtext is this. The subtext is, hey, this is an all-volunteer force. These guys have chosen to serve their country, and who can blame someone if after 7 or 8 deployments their, you know, their morals go a little bit askew? I mean, we're fighting a vicious enemy. But And there's almost a sense of embedded guilt, you know, by the vast majority of Americans who do not serve, saying, hey, who are we to judge these guys? But you and I, and hopefully most of our listeners who do serve, know what an insidious argument that is, because we fight with the values that we represent. We don't adopt those of our enemy. If we do, what do we have left? You know, as Spencer said in his letter of resignation, if we don't represent the rule of law, what do we represent? And what are we fighting for? Because God knows it isn't always coherent policy, right, as we discussed on this show. You know,
well, you
when
know
it comes
Andy,
down to it.
I'll tell you what, I mean, and we've all seen this over and over. I mean, just so everybody knows, the military, when you're there, right, there's a left and right lateral limit of what's acceptable, right? And in the confusion and the quote-unquote fog of war. And we see it all the time, right? Civilians get killed because we set up at, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Every place in the battle space, we're going to conduct these snap VCPs. And we used to catch a lot of bad guys like this. Yeah, all of a sudden,
we shot a lot of people.
Too. Right, right. All of a sudden, we throw these things down everywhere, unbeknownst to anybody, right? And we have concertina, we have signs, we have pen flares, we have all this stuff, so we won't kill civilians. And then a father who's in a car sees it and he panics, right? Oh my God. Yeah. And he hits the gas and he's trying to, and they open fire on him because he's tripped the trigger line. And then they, in the Marines' perspective, they're protecting themselves from this car, potentially car bomb. And then 30 seconds later, they're trying to save a guy who got confused, his wife and three kids in the backseat. Right. And so we understand. And you know what? And that Marine leader, that corporal, that sergeant, right? That staff sergeant, that lieutenant, right? They have a moral obligation to defend their Marines and preserve their lives in a confusing situation. That's their first responsibility, right? And you try to do that to the best, but, and so when we review that legally, we understand that it's confusing. We do not fry our own. Okay, when you see somebody being charged with something, that is so outside the bell curve that it's not even in the gray area of the gray area. Okay, there's the gray area, then there's like, geez, you know, that's on the edge of it, but okay, right? So, and then there's that which is beyond all of that. And the first experience I had with it was that Illyrio Pintano. He's a second lieutenant.
Oh, yeah.
And, oh my, I mean, he shoots two guys. Changes magazines and pumps another 28 rounds in them, and then makes a sign and says, no better friend, no worse enemy. Now, I read the statements when they came in. I was working for General Mattis at the time. And yeah. I was like, holy shit. And then when I came back to the United States, the narrative was this. I heard Michael Savage screaming at him. This kid is a war hero, right? Yeah. This kid's a war hero, and the Marine Corps is screwing this kid. And I remember thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, the dude even changed magazines. And you're like, Wow, this is amazing,
you know,
which is exactly the same thing, right? You know, so you come home, you wrap yourself in the flag, and you say, it wasn't my fault, you know, I was doing my job, and the war is unfair, and all this other shit, and it's reminiscent of My Lai, right, and Medina, and Cali, and everything they said. It's not their fault, it's the system's fault.
Yeah, they all got to fight, and that is why, guys like you and me, and your listeners, that is why it's absolutely, the burden is on us to speak up, because the people who have not been to war and have not worn uniform won't, because they will always, always take that stance out of, you know, out of part of it, a sense of obligation, a sense of debt to those who serve. Right. So those of us who do, and you just summed it up very well. Yeah, in war, war's a messy business, and in war, civilians will die despite your best efforts. And, you know, it's not always an easy line to decide what is the right thing to do. You know, there is certainly, and the checkpoints were a great example. But, you know, even on checkpoints, and you know this, we learned, we went from, you know, 2003, 2004, just, you know, a lot of battalion commanders were telling Marines, hey, if you're in doubt, just fire them up, to understanding that we were undercutting our own position and killing a lot of innocent people, and commanders taking a more balanced view, saying, hey, listen, Marine, sometimes you've got to be sure of, you've got to be sure of the intent, and you've got to do your best to identify that your target before you do shoot. If that means waiting a split second later and maybe adding that risk to your life, that's a decision that you got to make. But we still didn't. You know, we still didn't turn guys in for bad calls on checkpoints.
No, and as you said, Andy, we got, so a big part of it was, right, where you decided, and since we're talking about snap VCPs, as we looked at these things hard, and really they came out of investigations into the deaths of civilians, what were the causal factors of this? Well, it was a poor location to do this. And so they didn't have very much time between this, they saw this car and they had to make a decision. So then it got to be a more mature approach of, okay, we got to put some time and scrutiny into choosing the locations, having spike strips and concertina so the car is crippled. It's going to roll into this concertina, and it will be outside of the ECR, you know, of a 155 round. So we'll be there. And so we actually, you know, started putting head, right, to maps, to, you know, data, and said, okay. And then those things went way down. We stopped traveling on the MSRs during the day.
Yeah.
Only things that moved during the day were combat movements that had to go. Other than that, moved at night when the curfew was going on. And again, deaths of civilians on the interstates because they got too close. They came, you know, right next to the vehicle, thought they were going to detonate. And so we fired them up. All that stuff, you know, so we got smart. And so
we extended our decision space,
right,
on these things, and it benefited us. And I'm very, you know, the story of the Marine Corps in Anbar Province, I'm very proud of. You know, a lot of us, I think, were dismayed at times during the early, you know, the early part, the march up, and the kind of theatrics of, honestly, frankly, some of the leadership at battalion level. But that evolved into great maturity, and we learned some hard lessons on counterinsurgency, but we learned them quickly and we learned them well, you know, thanks to efforts on the ground. But so to your point, you and I are absolutely eye to eye on this, and that's why obviously I'm appearing on your show. I want to go on and talk a little bit more about something else that lies under this, and you've talked about this too. So there's all, you know, at a higher level, there's now, there's kind of a struggle between, a president who wants to exercise his authority here, thinking that it is the right thing to do. And now it's become a political issue balanced against professional norms that you just summed up very well, that we understand that if you start sanctioning and applauding this type of behavior or saying it's okay, then what do we have left? And you've undercut leadership at every level, and it's a very, very dangerous precedent. Particularly so, this is what I wanted to talk about, particularly so when you have a cultural war going on already. You just sided with the bad side in that cultural war, and NSW is in the midst of a battle of cultures between the bad old NSW, as exemplified by SEAL Team 7 with their, you know, mass endorsement of war crimes and, you know, I mean, torturing a prisoner, basically, call it, you know, medical experimentation, drugs.
Just so you know, that part of the story is not widely told, right?
Yeah. I think it made the Navy Times.
Right.
You can,
but it's not widely told. The people that pay attention would know that. But a lot of people listening are saying, "What? They were doing what?"
Yeah. It's freaking sick. You know, you look at examples of that, many, you know, SEAL Team 10s, and this isn't me knocking the SEAL Team community. It really isn't. I've known many great leaders, but they're having a problem. Drugs in SEAL Team 10, the sexting things with SEAL Team 6, the murder of Logar. By two SEAL Team 6 members. And then when you look into that, just the weird freakiness behind that, the fact that they were those guys were involved in, you know, defrauding the government. Melgar had found out. Logan Melgar, I'm sorry. I incorrectly pronounced his name. But he found out. And then not only, you know, did they come in with this ridiculous hazing thing that's very obviously dangerous and threatening his life, but they planned to bring in this Malian dude to rape him and videotape it. I mean, this is not fucking normal behavior. This isn't the behavior of people who've been subjected to too much combat and, you know, are having problems dealing with it. These are truly sick people who should not be wearing uniform. You know what I mean?
Right.
So Admiral Green, who I'm a big fan of Admiral Green, and I'm a big fan of the two, you know, the primary commodores within the SEAL community, Chris Brown and Eric Schaefer. Chris has group one and Eric Schaefer's group two. They are fighting a war right now. And, you know, you've seen the stuff that Admiral Green has put out. Hey, and we're going to get back. Because you guys have gone so far out the fold, we're going to return to normal military grooming standards and everything else. You know, I mean, can you imagine saying that to the SEALs?
No, no. I mean, and honestly, you know, Andy, do you not believe that Admiral Green's, you know, getting towed to Cat 2 right now?
Oh, man, yeah.
I mean, let me tell you, I mean, in my opinion, he'll be gone before the end of the week.
Yeah, he's on very, very thin ice, but, you know, he's got a lot of moral courage.
Well, that's what this story is about. It's about, there's a lot of people who say at confirmation hearings, truth to power. Will you do it when it's going to cost you your career? Because the reason we didn't have phase four thought through in Afghanistan was because Tommy Franks didn't have the balls to say, we can't go if you can't tell me what this looks like. Right? And we did it again in Iraq. We did it again. No phase plan for phase four in Iraq. Right? And we did not have general officers other than Greg Newbold who stood up and said, hey, this is bullshit. I can't do this.
Awesome,
this
dude.
Is wrong.
Awesome,
and the world is still not done paying for it. All these hundreds of thousands of people that are dead are on American stupidity. And again, in my opinion, the moral failure of the general officers and the flag officers of this country. And they've got to start getting it fucking right. And Spencer, to me, and Green are standing up in a way that we have to begin to stand up again.
Yeah, so, you know, there's the part we talked about that is kind of the general uneasiness that we have. Uneasiness probably an underestimate. It's an understatement about the commander-in-chief undermining the message that you and I and everyone in a position of responsibility, certainly within the Marine Corps, has tried to enforce about, hey man, you got to make the right call. We represent certain values and we fight with those values. Undermining that, and then you throw in the culture war. So it's not just about war crimes. It really is about good order and discipline. But it isn't, you know, the risk isn't just ill, you know, bad discipline as far as, hey, a high number of DUIs or people talking back to the guys over them. I mean, we're talking about rapes and murders, you know, drug taking, all kinds of freaky, feral stuff going on that just needs to be stamped out. And
okay, Andy,
Admiral Green, the first guy determinedly trying to tackle this,
right,
and I think he's going to be gone. That bodes badly for the NSW community.
So how deep is the fracture in that community? And because the moral of the Gallagher trial is don't side against us. That's what came out of that trial.
That's right.
The guys who did what the Navy and the SEAL community were telling them to do is we've got to be better. We've got to stand up for what's right, and you cannot be afraid to self-report. Well, they did, and they went under the bus, and now they're ostracized. I don't know that I'm not an insider in that community. Are those guys now ostracized from that community? Will they be eliminated from that community?
There's certainly, I mean, I'm not at deck plate level within the SEAL community, but what I hear, yes, is there's certain, there's a huge amount of that whole incident has caused a massive rift, not just within SEAL Team 7, but problems through, you know, obviously throughout the community. And that is what that's what Admiral Green and his Group 1 Commodore were desperately trying to do, was to take these guys who turned Gallagher in and say, these are the real heroes of the story.
Right.
But instead, you know, even the president has referred to them as, you know, patsies and right. sneaks and underhand people. And it's, it's really disturbing.
Yeah, it's gross. It's disgusting, because if you know any part of the truth, it's like the world is upside down, and then Gallagher's on TV saying this is about ego. Well, no shit, it's about ego. And we know whose ego is it about. It's about his ego and the things that he did wrong, and trying to play his lack of a conviction to innocence. Which everybody knows that's bullshit. And again, do it in front of God and the American people, with the backup of the President of the United States, and shoving their skewed version of life down everybody's fucking throat and saying, we're what's right. We're what's true. And you're watching it going, I can't fucking believe this is happening.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it, the implications, you know, when I said, hey, it all goes badly for the SEAL community, actually, it portends ill for all of us who wear uniform. And I just want to touch on something you said earlier. So there's some churn about what exactly happened over the weekend and what's in the media right now is that, and it seems like everyone's agreed on this, that on Friday, Esper and Milley went to the president and tried to talk him out of him intervening in the Trident pulling case.
Right.
And by the accounts in the media, they were successful. You know, by Friday evening, everyone went home thinking, okay, all right, so the president's going to back off and let this be an NSW internal affair. They've decided that Gallagher did not serve with honor and integrity and they're going to pull his trident, you know, and then that's going to be it. And then somehow something happened over the weekend, and then by Sunday, Spencer was relieved, and he was relieved supposedly because he went behind Esper's back and spoke to the president to try and cut a deal on the Gallagher case, cut a deal in the sense of, you know, Gallagher keeping his trident, but something else happening. Who knows? This is all hearsay. But anyway, so Spencer is gone, and then today, Esper and Milley, you saw Spencer's resignation letter, and Spencer's resignation letter does make it sound as though it was about the Trident case. The president's saying it's got nothing to do with Gallagher at all, that Spencer's gone. He's saying it's to do with funding for the Abraham Lincoln, a bunch of other stuff, you know. It's just, it gets really weird.
Right.
But let's get back to Esper and Milley. All right, this gets back to a topic that we've talked about a lot. So you've got the senior most uniformed guy, and you've
okay,
got...
Okay, so hold on. I just want to lay this out because I went down this road a little bit ago. So I want to lay this out. So the triangle that you carve up, so if it was a process violation by Spencer, right, and this thing was going to be allowed to go forward, okay, then what I'm hearing the president say out of his Twitter account and what I'm hearing Esper and Milley say is different.
Yeah,
and there's a
different.
And there's a confrontation.
And what Spencer's saying is different, too.
And there's a confrontation that's still yet to be resolved if what you said about Milley and Esper, what they did on Friday, is accurate. The president's not saying that. The president says, this is over, and that's not what you said Esper and Milley said. But the headline in Stars and Stripes this morning is Milley said, this is completely over.
That's right. So now Milley has said that. What's interesting is what is going on. I mean, I'd love to know what's going on behind the scenes. Because if Milley and Esper did indeed go to the president and say, hey, boss, you got to back off on this. We're asking you to back off. And the president agreed, but then went back on that. And then if that actually happened, then what do Milley and Esper next do? You know, and this gets back to what you and I talked about before. Do you simply say, okay, all right, Roger, push on? Or do you say, oh no, hey, wait a second. That cuts to the core of what I find really important and I'm going to resign over this. We'll see, you know, but I would hope that there's a limit to how many times that you say, in that position when you can affect things. And I'm talking about the senior most civilian Department of Defense and the senior most uniformed guy. There's got to be a limit, I hope, for them, for the amount of times they just go, okay, Roger that, boss. Yep, we will do that. Yep.
Well, let me just tell you, what's sad, Andy, and again, you go back to, did you read McMaster's Dereliction of Duty?
I did, Dereliction of Duty, yeah.
Okay, the quote, the one quote in there that is haunting to me is General Johnston, who is the Chief of Staff of the Army, said, after all of this, I now have to go to my grave, knowing that I did not live up to the oath that I swore to my country.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, at least he realized that. Plenty of dudes don't.
Well, no. And you think about that. And it's like there's this thing, I guess, from watching it that happens when you become not a military leader anymore. You become a politician, the steward of your own brand. Look, you're a general, man. Your life's made. You're gonna retire as a wealthy human being. You're gonna go get a job someplace if you want it, where people will be glad to have you, and you'll make a shit ton of money. So
shit, regardless of what you do,
regardless, yeah. So yeah, so why, when it's, in my opinion, when it's so fucked up and wrong, and you know why, and that's why I think, you know, now the white hot spotlight is on Milley and Esper.
Yep.
So this whole false narrative about Gallagher being a victim and the president doing the exact wrong thing for the uniformed military services, you're okay with that. You're going to shut up in color. And that's what we all take away from this.
Yep. Yeah, you know, and so maybe they're saying to themselves, hey, this isn't really that important. Gallagher's small fish. But then they kind of missed the point. Yeah, life will go on if Gallagher doesn't have his trident pulled, but that's not at issue here. That issue is everything that we've laid out. It's
The issue is the fight for the soul of that community.
Yeah. And on a larger point, just the question of good order and discipline, for want of a better word, and values, core values of the military community, that decision undercut all of that. And put commanders at any level in a bad position. So it gets back to what I said at the beginning, right? Just because you have the right to do something, and that, yeah, you know, I keep hearing this on the radio and as in defense of the decision. Just because you have the right to do something does not make it the right thing to do.
No, absolutely. And that's what, to me, it's like, well, it's civilian control of the military. No shit. But I don't have to stay here and be your dancing monkey, okay? I don't have to do that. And I will resign, and like Mattis did, I will articulately, in a restrained way, say that he is wrong, and I will not participate in this. And I will allow my life's work, right, coupled with this statement, to say everything that I feel I need to say as I walk out the door. And Spencer did the same thing. You know, and again, I'm with you. You're watching the political agents try to spin this, right? When I believe Spencer and Green last week, when they talked about this going forward, right, in the small group, you know, and the SecNav within an even smaller group of his staff, they looked at him and said, you know, if you go down this road. And you know what he said? I know, but I can't have this. I don't need this job. I love being the Secretary of the Navy, but I'm not going to be his dancing chicken.
Yeah.
And so it
certainly is. And so even, you know, let's move off Gallagher for a moment. Let's talk about the other two involved in this, all right? Matt Goldstein. And I know guys who know Goldstein well and think highly of him. And, you know, Goldstein is allegedly killed an alleged IED, a guy who placed IEDs, or actually made IEDs, after he was released from custody. So, you know, I'm not going to conjecture on his guilt or innocence, but the point is he was scheduled to go to trial, and at that trial, you know, we'll have faith in the military justice system, his guilt or innocence would have been determined. But it makes no sense to pardon, you know, just to say, I don't think it makes sense, and it sends a very damaging message to say, hey, he's not even going to go to trial. If he's innocent, let him go to trial. So there again, there was a preemptive and I think not well thought out decision. It would send the wrong message. I mean, hey, we're not even going to try to hold someone accountable if they're suspected of this, if they admit to doing something, which goes.
And again, it's so much of it is driven by what's in the media, which the president responds to. And so, you know, it's like, oh, these guys are getting railroaded. Oh, well, if you look at the facts of this stuff, if you look at the statements, you will see more than a modicum of evidence that supports not only the charges, but the prosecution. Now, your role here, Mr. President, is when it's all adjudicated, you can do whatever you want as commander in chief.
That's right. But let it at least run to trial.
Let these guys, let these guys do what they're hired and supposed to do by law, because if you clip them, right, if you clip them, then you're going to leave them no response but to resign and badmouth you on the way out. And some of these guys will do that. Some will not, but some will, and that is not going to look good. That is not going to look good for us.
And then the third case, Lawrence. So Lawrence, and again, I don't know if you've already discussed the, you know, the Lawrence case, so I'm going to cover it very quickly. Right. But back in 2012, Lawrence, a brand new platoon commander, platoon leader in Army Pont Lance in Afghanistan, he orders his guys to open fire on the three dudes on, I think it was on two motorcycles. They hadn't, you know, they hadn't run a VCP or anything. My understanding is that they were, you know, they were riding by a fob, but there seemed no other reason to shoot at them. And one of his soldiers, at least one of his soldiers, didn't hit them. The motorcyclist stopped and approached an ANA checkpoint. Apparently, the ANA guys checked him out, allowed them to pass, and Lawrence told his guys to open fire on them again, and they did to include with a 240 and killed. I can't remember if they killed three or they killed two of them, but certainly two of them were killed. And then Lawrence's guys turned him in, and you know, similar to Gallagher, just said, "Hey, you know, this is what happened." And it wasn't that they turned him in because they were being charged. They reported the incident, and you know, it was a violation of the law of war. And one of his squad leaders came across very articulately in an interview on the media, just saying, "Hey, look, this wasn't not about likes or dislikes or anything like that. But what he told it, those guys to do was wrong, and it's going to live on their conscience forever, and he needs to answer to this." So, you know, there was no, at the subsequent trial, there was all kinds of weird defense, arguments that, hey, someone had taken the fingerprints of the corpses and traced it through biometrics to, you know, guys who were wanted, as though Lawrence could have known that at the time, even if it was true. But anyway, so Lawrence gets sentenced. I forget how long he was sentenced to. I think it was it 12 years? I don't know. And then he's just been sprung from jail. And so I don't know if you've seen some of the interviews in the media this morning with his former platoon, you know, his former soldiers who are like, "What the hell just happened? You know, we turned this guy in. He was a war criminal, and now he's being let out."
Well, I mean, which is
another case.
If the SEALs could talk, that's what they would say, right? I mean, but those guys aren't saying. If the platoon that turned Gallagher in, three separate times they went to their leadership and said, "Something's got to be done about this," right? And so the way they're now colored is, oh, they're disgruntled. They, you know, they were haters. They weren't part of the team. And that's the way you begin the ostracization process and alienate them as we all close ranks and lie for each other so nothing happens to us. Cause that's the way we get through this shit. And you hear, you know, if they were talking, they would say the exact thing that those soldiers said. What the hell? And it doesn't bode well for good order and discipline, because what it tells people is that you can do whatever you want, right? We have the guns. We could do whatever the hell we want to. And in some way, shape, or form, you'll get let out of it because, oh, it happened at war. And everything's forgivable in war.
And it's a terrifying concept.
Right.
You know, we wield so much, we have the capacity for so much destruction in the United States military. And to take away the shackles from, you know, not the shackles, but take away the any sense of judicious use of that violence is a scary thought.
And scary for us. And let me tell you this. Ultimately, right, in our song, there's a morals clause in our song. Nobody else has one. First to fight for right and freedom and to keep your honor clean. Keep your honor clean is mental health advice for us. All right. We don't keep our honor clean for the Marine Corps, because Andy, you know this, you have to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And if you can't do that because you lied, because you murdered, because you did things that got other people injured or killed, nobody can lift that burden from you, no matter what. Gallagher knows he did. Gallagher knows what he did. That Corman, he knows what he did too. He lied, right? And he enabled this whole narrative, right? And they have to live with that shit. They have to live with that shit. And so keep your honor clean is the emotional and spiritual armor that we put on ourselves. That's why we do the right thing. And this encroaches on that. And it's not good. It is not good.
No, I couldn't agree more. I had a thought, but it just as this so often happens, just drifted away. I know what it was. SEAL Team 7. So returning to them, it just gives you an idea of how. Of where this culture war is in terms of escalation. When, during their latest shenanigans, when they got kicked out of, the platoon got kicked out of Iraq for drinking, and then there was it's one of the senior enlisted guys within that platoon is facing, charges of rape. And so in the aftermath of that, Admiral Greene fires the SEAL team commander and his senior enlisted advisor. And those guys went to the IG and they're now going after Green. It's just like, you can't make this up, you know?
No, I mean,
so he's getting it from all sides. And now being undercut by the president is putting him in a bad position. And it's, you know, we've seen the SEAL community. They've had some rough times culturally in the last two decades. And here at last is a guy who's really making a determined effort to turn it around and change that. And I agree with you. I don't think it's going to last. I don't think he's going to last.
Well, and what happens? I mean, so this thing, you know, who's in control of this? I mean, this thing is spun out of control to where, you know, the liars have toppled the Secretary of the Navy with the help of the President of the United States. So who stands up for what's right? What happens if you're, in my opinion, this whole leadership crisis in the Navy is coming to a culminating point here. And the admirals of the Navy have to, you know, what do they stand for? I mean, Commander Bryce Benson's going to retire at the same rank that he held when he allowed his ship, right, to transit an international, you know, thoroughfare at 22 knots with degraded radar on the first night out of a port with neither he nor his XO on the bridge during the passage, right?
Now, experienced team on the bridge.
Yeah, if we as Marines crewed that son of a bitch and we said, well, our radar is a little bit degraded, we have some inexperienced people, hey, how about this? How about we slow this son of a bitch down a little bit and give ourselves some time here? Okay, not, I mean, it's stupid. And nobody's going to pay for that. Nobody's going to pay for that. And so to me, the Navy, I mean, and the UCMJ, I had Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney on, you know, the UCMJ, I mean, now the whole San Diego JAG community is under investigation by the Navy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I was going to add that. Yeah.
Right? And so, and I would tell you about the Logan Melger, his murder. Would you say, Andy, that it was their intention to murder him?
I don't know. A good friend of mine was connected with that trial. So one of the lawyers said, I don't know, but it's almost irrelevant. You know, they intended to do him harm, right? Okay. I mean,
but if you're a prosecutor,
choking someone and then deciding to film him getting sexually assaulted, to me is, you know, it's tantamount to fucking trying to kill him.
Well, so I would tell you that to me what they should be charged with, if I'm a prosecutor and I'm looking for the truth and justice, it's manslaughter, right?
Yeah.
Now, I could charge them with murder if I want to get them to plea bargain, but I know I can't convict them of murder, right? Yeah. All the evidence points to these guys drunk, stupid, and living in a culture that does this kind of shit that doesn't get reined in. And so, So to me, the JAG community has its own problem in that it's lost, in my opinion. And then you have NCIS, you know, supposedly that has its issues where, you know, it is, you know, you get these stories about, yeah, they were fabricating statements. They were, you know, keeping guys sequestered for 8 hours as they interrogated them without their attorney and shit like that. That's not how it's supposed to be done. And so it's like we have this crisis across the JAG community and the UCMJ. Right. And the case and what brought this up was, you know, 1-5, a judge ruled that, you know, 1-5 had having a formation and calling out all the Marines that were involved in drug trafficking and human smuggling. That was a violation of those Marines' rights.
And
right. And the thought is, well, wait a minute. Isn't the UCMJ supposed to promote good order and discipline?
Yeah.
It's not.
It was an extraordinary decision, wasn't it?
Yeah. This is not the civilian community. The UCMJ exists, right, to promote good order and discipline inside the military. As such, right, a defendant's rights exist in the context of that, not separate from it. So, I mean, to me, it's a system that's having a huge crisis right now, and it's going, and it impacts. And my attitude is, hey, look, I don't give a fuck if they throw the charges out against all those guys. Get them the fuck out of the Marine Corps. And if I was a battalion commander, I would have done the exact same damn thing. Yeah. Everybody needs to see this shit. Okay.
You're right. It's an institutional problem. It's not just about, you know, the Gallagher case. It's, yeah, the whole JAG Corps. And it's not just about the JAG Corps. It's the, as you said, the perception of, you know, the UCMJ, of what good order and discipline and accountability means within the Department of the Navy. And the examples of the Fitzgerald and McCain are good examples because they were, you know, they were the tip of the spear results of years of neglect, years of people shirking their responsibility, you know, as far as getting Seventh Fleet, what they needed in terms of, you know, adequately trained crews, and ships that were properly equipped.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's an endemic institutional problem. And so whoever succeeds Spencer, I hope he's a really good dude. You know, I mean,
well,
this is one
I know,
time.
But the fear is, right? Another yes man. A bobblehead. Okay. Okay, what else?
Yeah.
What's
your impression of Esper so far?
Company man. He's a B-team guy. He's a B-team guy. He's not going to stand up to the President of the United States. And to me, this is like, okay, well, if that's true, then, and what you said was right, Andy, that they pushed back. But that's never been Trump's narrative. Trump's narrative was, I want Gallagher, right? Nothing will happen to him. Well, that doesn't sound like, and then, so if they did on Friday say, let this go through, right? And then what pissed the president off was, you know, the story that leaked that said Spencer was willing to resign over this. And then the president says, I'm not having that. He's making me look bad now, so he's gone. And then everybody rolls up. Okay, he's gone. So if I'm Esper, okay, he's gone, Mr. President. But that process we agreed on still goes through. And you can do what you want at the end of it, right? You would expect to see that. And then if you're Esper and the president says no, that's gone too. If you're Esper, that's the charcoal that just got dumped in your lap.
That's what I mean is that I'm looking at Esper and Milley now, and I'm wondering, you know, this is going to be a test of their character going ahead. So they may or may not have just rolled over, but the point is they can't keep rolling over. You know, if they do, that's not what we expect of guys in those positions.
But it's, I mean, as you know, and I can hear it in your voice, I mean, we need them to stand up for the right thing because this is the wrong. The Navy is down the wrong road, man. The Navy is down the wrong road, and it's so disturbing to watch it. And then it's being held up for the American people. Like this is the way it should be. Gallagher is his hero, and everybody else is fucking him over. And the answer is no, 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 no.
Yeah, that is certainly the the political undertone that is emerging from this, and again, this isn't me being partisan either side, but unfortunately, the president's party has closed ranks in support of him on this issue, and makes it and plays into just the dangerous subtext that you and I talked about. You know, hey, these guys, they go to war, they're war heroes. Who really cares if they do a few things, bad things, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Isn't that right? Isn't that normal in war?
Yeah.
Right. It's like asking, I remember that kind of interesting. The guy, one of the company commanders at Quezon, I befriended through a Lance Corporal by the name of Ken Rogers, who was a Lance Corporal at Quezon, who made a documentary called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Watch that. It's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me before.
Watch it. It's amazing. Anyway, Ken Pipes was a company commander at Quezon. And he struggled with some of the decisions he made. And I wanted him to come on and talk about it. But he passed away before he did. But he would call me at night. And one night he calls me and says, hey, Mac, do you know anything about Mili? And I said, oh, yeah, I know a little bit. And then after I got the phone, I said, I don't really know that much about Mili. So I started reading and watching videos. Holy shit, it was the exact opposite of what I thought.
Yeah.
And then I started learning about it, and I looked at what happened, and it was like the American people, you know, give everybody a pass, right, because, oh, it's war and this shit happened. So then I brought on guys who were Vietnam guys. And the conversation I wanted to have was rape, was disfiguring bodies, was that a part of your war? And they all said no. I was in a good unit, right? And in fact, Ken Rogers, Lance Corporal, said, at the end of Quezon, right, when the NVA were not around so much, we started moving out and looking for them, right, to reestablish contact. And we went through this by this bat, you know, and we'd been doing this for 77 days was a siege of Quezon. So this is towards the end of that. We go out. Now, this pile of bodies is there. They got caught in something and they got vaporized, right? One of my buddies grabs a femur out of the pile and sticks it in his war belt. He said within 3 minutes, one of our corporals walks up and says, get rid of that thing right fucking now. And he did. And he said, that's what I was a part of. Rape? We didn't have, there's no, you know, we were fighting the NVA, so it wasn't an opportunity. Guys who were, right, closer to the coast, where there was more of the fight of with the VC, right, they said, like, no, rape, no, we're doing patrolling. There's people out there trying to kill us. You're looking for, you know, IEDs, you know, rape somebody in the context of that. How the hell would you even do that? So no. So it was really interesting for me, you know, to get guys on from that period and say, but, and then they would say this, but I heard stories and they always came from shit units with shit leaders.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, Kelly's platoon was a case in point. I encourage anyone who hasn't read the full story to read it. There's some really good articles about it, and I believe there's been a book written about it. But yeah, to your point, Kelly sanctioned rape. You know, he allowed it. And one of the soldiers testified that when they moved into a village, you know, the locals just assumed the girls were going to get raped because that's what Kelly allowed. Kelly shot an unarmed farmer in front of his platoon, joked about it like 2 days before the massacre at Mili. And then when you read details of the massacre, 10-year-old girls were raped in that village. You know, this isn't some weird allegation. This is guys involved in the massacre saying that. You know, you just need to read the testimony. And the real hero, as you know, the whole story was Thompson, Chief Warrant Officer Thompson,
who
lowered his helicopter between Kelly's men and the villagers and told his gunner to shoot the next American who pursued the villagers. And sadly, Thompson was vilified.
Oh my God.
Afterwards. Yeah. And Kelly became a hero, man. I mean, like I just exchanged emails with some dude who was from his same hometown, and you know, the high school wanted to name the gym after him and everything. It's just like, God, Yeah, so we're running to, you know.
So here, let me read you an email.
That same sort of.
Let me read you an email.
Narrative.
Mac, fascinating, because the narrative that's coming out of the military is completely counter to the president's narrative and the people that are advocating his position. My question is, how does this end? Andy, how does this end? The SEAL community is in a fight for its soul right now. How does this end?
Yeah. I'm afraid I'm a pessimist and an optimist. Okay, so on as far as the cultural war within the SEAL community, it all depends on whether Green gets allowed left in place and whether Milley and Esper are able to, you know, to back him up and prevent him going. So a lot depends on those two. If Green goes, I can't think of a good outcome, not just for the SEALs, but the special operations community. Okay, so that's on the cultural issue. I'm a little more optimistic on this topic of the law of armed conflict, because between the president and the guys who are put on the pointed end and have to make these decisions are many, many people, like many of your listeners, in positions of responsibility and leadership within the military, who will do the right thing, regardless of what decisions the president makes. I don't know if you share that view, but that is mine.
Honestly, Andy, I'm more pessimistic. I believe that something happens to general officers when they attain that rank and they lose their moral courage. And, I mean, I've watched it. I watched it when General Furness started talking about discipline. Right? Everybody who's a Marine knows that the Marine Corps has got to have that conversation. Everybody knows it. Not one general officer, not one general officer, Dale Alford was the only one that made any comment about that in public. Everybody else, like, are you fucking kidding me?
No, I agree with you. And
stunning.
By the way, I'm a big fan of Dave Furness.
He's a friend of mine, but even if we were enemies, anybody who served has seen this happen over time. The Marine Corps getting less discipline, and that nobody says shit about it. We all act like, oh, nothing to see here, boys. Keep moving. Bullshit.
Well, here's a thought for you, and this isn't me saying this because I didn't make general officer, but you know, you said, hey, I don't know what happens to guys when they make general. I wonder whether, though, it isn't the fact that because of the system that we have, the system doesn't end up selecting the sort of guy who has perhaps been a yes man. In other words, that the promotion system is such that it tends to favor those who do go with the flow.
And well, let me tell you, how do you
regularly speak out, speak their minds, or just don't make it that high.
Well,
and,
so to
and
me,
there are
exceptions.
Don't get me wrong. There's plenty of exceptions, and you named one, obviously, Dave Furness.
But he's the exception, right? I mean, to me, there ought to be a quota for 10% of our generals ought to be people that click off safe quickly and speak the truth, and we can all hide behind the rest of them, and then we'll shit can them after they're major generals.
I mean, I agree with you. I think. It isn't so moral courage, I think, is one issue. And the other, frankly, is intellect. I'm not sure we always promote the smartest guy.
Whoa! You just played the intellect card.
I think if you get a handful of Marines in the same room, we might agree. We could probably name a number of senior officers within our own service who perhaps don't have the intellect for their position.
Wow.
But I bet that's a whole different.
That's a different kettle of fish, my friend. And look, I'm okay with that as long as they have the fucking moral courage to stand. You don't need to be a Mensa to say, if we're not disciplined, we're not the Marine Corps, and we're going to have this conversation. And I don't like Furness. Actually, I think he's a shithead, okay? But he's right about this, and we're going to have this conversation. Nobody in the fucking Marine Corps said that. Crazy.
Yep. No, I agree. I disagree with you on the intellect piece. I'm not talking about Mensa. But honestly, today, you need to be a smart dude to be a general officer. You really do. And the Marine Corps, despite the fact that we've always paid lip service to PME, we are kind of an anti-intellectual organization, to be honest with you.
Kind of?
How many PhDs do we have in active duty?
None. Fuck no, we don't allow it.
And the Air Force, and you can say, tell me, well, that PhD doesn't mean anything. Well, it means something. And the Army manages to have plenty of PhDs in active duty who are also warriors. You know, and I mean, shit, didn't patrol. I think that actually that's a bad example, right? But there's, you know, they have a system such that they will select guys and they won't kill their careers and they will educate them and then they will be teachers at West Point and then they'll go out and command brigades and pick up stars. And no one can challenge those guys' intellect. You know, whether or not you disagree or dislike McMaster, no one can say that he was a dummy. But he was, you know, the Army does a good job of taking guys like that. You know, he wrote a book that was, I think he was, shit, what was he when he wrote that book? It was back in the mid-90s, so he must have been
Colonel?
A major?
Yeah, major.
Captain? I don't know.
I thought it was major lieutenant colonel, maybe.
The Marine
maybe
Corps
lieutenant colonel.
Yeah, you could be right.
But the Marine Corps has always had that anti-intellectual, oh, he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Right. And it starts in recruit training, right? So the smartest guy, what nickname does that guy get or girl? Genius. Where's genius? And it's a human being. Hey, genius is over there. Come here. He or she is the smart person. But trust me, you do not want that tag of genius.
No, you don't.
Right. And so, it's a problem. It's a problem because it's good to be smart. And if you're going to be, and what you want is you want smart, decisive leaders who aren't afraid. That's what you want. And at some point, you got to put advertisements in recruit training for that. And you have to extol the virtues of being smart. Like we can make fun of it a lot. Okay. But when we do this, we're going to talk about we have been filled with, our ranks have been filled with smart people who improvise on the fly, who are decisive. And that's what we expect you to be in spite of all the other tomfoolery.
And being smart obviously isn't enough. You need, you know, you need that curious mixture of emotional intelligence that we call leadership.
Right.
But we've all suffered in our times under dudes who are just plain stupid. And it doesn't, you know, and there's just nothing worse.
The worst is working for somebody stupid. After you've worked for somebody that's smart. Because if you just work for mediocre people and then you work for somebody stupid, you're like, all right, he's stupid. But if you've seen the promised land and you've lived in the promised land and that is leadership under brilliant, driven, funny people who challenge you, it's heaven. It is heaven on earth. And then elevator going down. But it doesn't stop at the main floor anymore because you've gone higher. It has to go in the fucking basement. And then you're so pissed because you know better. You know what it looks like. You know what it smells like. And you know what it tastes like. And you're working for somebody who crushes all of that.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Hey, you know, that's another great topic for one of your shows, leading up. You know, so it'd be really interesting to get in two or three guys. You know, maybe whose careers have already gone out so they can talk frankly. But we get taught so much about leading down, you know, from JJ did tie buckle, you know, we roll out into the fleet and we're just ready to grab those, you know, 40 or so Marines and lead them. But we learn nothing about leading up. And I don't mean just when you, as you invariably do, get a shitty boss. But also with a good boss, you know, how to shape him, how to give him what he needs, how to support him. But especially with a guy who is struggling or a fear biter, or is destroying the unit in some way. And it occurs to me, like back in the 90s, for instance, that was a big deal for a lot of us rolling out the fleet. It was before command selection and the horror stories coming out of battalions about battalion commanders. Back then were legion. And there was just no, you know, it just seemed as though, unless they did something criminal, you know, there were a few cases some of which you'll be familiar with, where guys did something criminal. For instance, in my battalion, we had a battalion commander who tried to force his way into the hotel room of one of his officers' fiancés at 29 Palms, you know, to come on to her. Now, that crossed the line even back then, and he was gone. And there was another, a little bit later, right, you know, after the 90s, or right at the end of the 90s, who showed his penis to a group of his last corporals in a bar, and another who threatened his driver with a weapon. Now, that, you know, those sort of things crossed the boundary, but the norm were guys who were pretty bad leaders. So, I'll stop there.
Wow.
Are you still there?
We don't speak this frankly too often, and that's why I wanted to have you on, because honestly, man, what I believe is that, you know, underneath this very high-level fight is a fight that's going on for the soul of the Naval Special Warfare community. Who's going to win this fight?
Absolutely.
Are the people that never side against another SEAL no matter what, are they going to win? Or is truth, justice, and the American way going to win, which is what people are trying to get back at the center of the culture, which they've clearly lost their way through? And so who's going to win that? Well, if I was, you know, prognosticating, I would say, look, the truth, justice, and American way guys are losing at every fucking fight. And so you're going to have to be prepared to fall on your shield and to fall on your sword, right, in this fight if we're going to win this. And you can't be afraid. And Green's going to be the next one. Green's going to be the next one. And we'll see what the CNO has to say about this, you know, because this affects him. And so there's got to be people that stand up and say, we have to stand up for the right thing. And this is not doing well for us because, you know, and it, I mean, to me, that's the concern of all this. And then you're going to get to the point where I had somebody email me over the weekend. Is it time that we made, you know, SEALs go away? Let them go back to be frogmen in the surf. This thing is so corrupt. It's so foul. You know, turn all the missions over to Delta Force, expand Delta, right, and let the SEALs go back to being underwater demolition technicians. I was like, wow.
Yeah, you know, the crux of the cultural issue here was, as we talked about, you know, the guys who spoke up against Gallagher, they were breaking the code of the omerta, you know, the Sicilian code of silence.
Right.
And again, they have been silenced themselves, and so it doesn't bode well. Okay, yeah, I agree, man. Now I sense we're on that terribly pessimistic point, right, where we're coming to a close.
Well, I mean, to me, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how optimistic are you, right, that this is going to turn out well, given what you've seen today? I'm not going to hold you to this forever, but on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say that I'm like at a 2.5 that this turns out good. I don't believe that our flag officers in the Navy have the moral courage to do what's necessary, which means a number of them are going to have to resign and be public about it and say why. I don't see that coming. And so I see the bad forces that have existed and have the president on their side, excuse me. I see them winning in the short term, and I'm not sure how this cultural problem changes, you know, with that. So give yourself a number. If I'm at 2.5, where are you?
Yeah, I'm at a 5.5.
Oh,
and
shit.
Here's why I'm a little bit higher, because even if worse comes to worse, so as I said, a lot's going to depend on Milley and Esper, you know, whether they support Green. But even if the worst thing happens, now I'm thinking about it, and Green goes, there are some great commanders at O6 level in the SEAL community. And you know, I can't imagine that whoever replaces Green, and I won't speculate, that, you know, he's going to backtrack totally on what Green was trying to do. It's going to be very interesting to see, because if they fire Green, the next dude who comes into that position has a very, very, he's confronted with a moral dilemma, right?
Right
you
away.
Know, do I do the right thing for the community and get fired too? Or do I just buckle down?
Right. What do I do?
But I've got some faith in the O6, a great deal of faith in the O6 leadership. So shout out any SEALs who are listening. Captains Chris Brown and Eric Schaefer are good dudes, and I think they will continue to lead the community in the right direction, unless they get fired too. So I hope not. We'll see.
Right. Well, no. I mean, again, I think we're all rooting for them, but those of us who've served with them have seen the issues, and the issues have been going on for a long time. And so this is not something that cropped up recently. They played by their own set of rules. They lived by their own grooming standards, and we've all seen it, and they've done it for decades. And now it's reached a crisis point, and the evil forces are winning, quite frankly. So it's going to take, in my opinion, an uncommon effort by not just one, but a series of people that stand up and say, hey, this is wrong. We can't have it. And so the question is, will that happen? And that's why I'm not optimistic. I think so many people make a deal with the devil saying, you know, I'm better off inside working it than I am looking at it on the outside. And then from that, they don't, you know, they make peace with that which they should not make peace with. And everybody finds a way to rationalize it because they don't want to go out, resigning and like that. But you know what? Sometimes it's what is necessary for the greater good of the institution. And so we'll see what happens. I'm just not optimistic based on historical things that I've seen. So anyway.
Damn, Mac. We started off so well, talking about Thanksgiving.
I felt a different way, but I've just seen it happen too many times where people find a way to rationalize that which they should not rationalize, and ultimately, and I think this should be more of a topic of discussion, and that is, what are the circumstances under which you would resign? And
yeah.
So,
oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right? And I think that's an important conversation to have. And so, when you can't serve, when what you're being asked to do is immoral, then you have to look at it and say, you know what, I'm now at such a position that I have to look at this in a way that I probably didn't look at it when I was younger in my career. I'm now occupying a position that is critical, and I'm being asked to go along with something that, I can't go along with. And so, I don't know, man.
When we tell people illegal or immoral,
right.
When it comes to both, actually, there is certainly a gray area. So I think a good way to do it is when you get asked to do something that's antithetical to your values. So rolling into a position of leadership at that level, you need to decide what your values are. If you have, I would hope that most general officers have decided that before they make general officer. But nevertheless, and at what point are you going to continue to say yes when those values are being undermined by what you're doing?
Right. And we've seen.
Hopefully, and S. Barron Pitt are asking themselves that.
We've seen some of our favorites, right? Secretary Mattis left like that.
You know?
General Kelly left like that. H.R. McMaster. Now, maybe there was other fractures in there, but I think one of the things to make this political, right now, Donald Trump, one of the things that I think, as much as he was a novice and an outsider, his initial group of people that he hired, you were like, okay, well, he's got strong, these are people that are men of integrity, right? You could put a gun to Mattis's head and tell him to lie, and he'll look at you and say, pull the trigger. I won't do it. He was surrounded with those kind of guys, and then slowly but surely every one of them's left. And you're wondering, like, okay, so how does this work out? And again, as you said, the people, in my opinion, that are now in the white hot spotlight are the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yep.
What do they do about this problem? And so we'll see what happens. So, Andy, first of all, Thanks for doing this. Not easy subjects. I always appreciate. And one of the reasons I called was because of your candor, Andy, that you're not afraid to talk about the truth. And there's so many guys who I could have called today who would have told me, Mac, I'd really rather not come on and talk about that. And I always appreciate your candor and about everything we talk about. And want to wish you and yours a happy Thanksgiving. So thanks for doing this.
Hey, Matt, it's always a pleasure, and I hope to be coming over to the West Coast sometime in the next few weeks, in which case you and I hope we'll get together and have a beer. And I send you a copy of my book, and I want you to try to read it, Matt. It's got lots of photos, but just, you know, read the foreword, read the first chapter. I think you'll be hooked. If not, then just call me and tell me it's a crappy book. I've known you long enough, you know, that it won't devastate me too completely.
You won't have to worry. I'll be more than happy to say, hey, Andy, this thing sucks, man. What were you doing? I've got in the next month, I'm trying to write two books in the next month. One is a book about post-traumatic winning, which I have in my head. I just have to, you know, I just have to get it on paper. And I don't want it to be a long book. I want it to be kind of like a soldier's load and the mobility of a nation. Something you could put in a cargo pocket. Something you could knock out in a night. But I want it to be blunt, to the point, and written so that everybody who ever struggled with trauma can benefit from the wisdom that comes from our Marine Corps culture. And then the other one is somebody gave me the idea to write a children's book.
Awesome.
How do you, you know, when you're confronted with one of your children being involved in some kind of, you know, witnessing some kind of traumatic event and they can't forget it, what do you tell them? How do you articulate that? How do you steward them through it? And we had to go through that as a family. When my nephews were murdered, my dad was in Major League Baseball, so the story went out on ESPN and then out on every newspaper across the country. So we did not have the luxury to tell my 10-year-old and 7-year-old sons that their 6-year-old and 4-year-old cousins were murdered by their father. That we did not have the luxury of saying, well, they passed away. We had to tell them that they were shot in the head by their father. And so what do you do with that, right? What do you do with that? And so hopefully it's a book about a little girl who sees something on the interstate, and what she sees is never articulated, but she just can't forget it. And she sits down with her father, and then she goes on this journey of talking to people and learns all these different things that all come from our culture. And then hopefully parents can sit down and read that with the child and say that now, you know, now that you know these things, what's really important is when you meet one of your friends that can't forget something, that you tell them that there's nothing wrong with you, that you're okay, and that you have to do what I do, which is talk to other kids like us and help them to understand that it's okay. And so I got to write that book.
Mac, that's an inspired thought. And only, you know, you're one of the few ones who's going to be able to do that one justice. So you need to push ahead and write that, regardless of what.
Well, no, but I still need to read.
That book certainly needs to be published. I'm sure you have, but think of all the uses of that book. You know, I mean, it's a great idea, and I know it's coming from the heart too, in your own experience.
Well, yeah, my own experience about, you know, instead of like groping my way through it, like I didn't know what to do, I didn't know what to say, I didn't know how to say it. And what I got told was you have to create a disconnect somehow or other between the anger of a parent and what happened today. And I said, well, do you have any, you know, like, well, no, you know your kids better than anybody, so you'll know what to say. And I was like, really? That's as much as you're going to give me? And I tried my best. And what I said was, and again, my 7-year-old son, who just got off active duty, he's an infantry officer in 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, and he was 7 years old. His feet, he was sitting next to me in the car as we drove down this hill, and his feet, legs were not even long enough that his feet touched the floor yet, right? His little legs, his little feet and shoes are sticking up, right, as we're driving down the hill. And he looks at me, and he says, why would a dad kill their kid with a gun? Boom. And,
wow.
Yeah, and what I came up with was, sometimes people go crazy, and when they go crazy, they do crazy things. And he went crazy today. He was not being a dad today. And that's as good as I could come up with. And so, I mean, I thought that, you know, so this book would be somebody who's gone through that. Well, and then I tell the story, and then I do in post-traumatic winning. A year later, we were in my hometown of Sacramento where this had happened, and my my younger son said, could we go to the cemetery? And so we went, and we, you know, it was brutal, man. I'd never seen the gravestones that they make for little kids. And, you know, I remember thinking, you know, you got to be tough for this, right? And that shit lasted at least 2 seconds, and it's too hard. And so we're walking back to the car after we said a prayer and we talked. And my oldest son was walking next to me, and he said, could I ask you a question? And I said, yeah. And he looks at me and he says, do you think it hurt? Now,
oh boy.
Exactly. I mean, here's my 10-year-old son trying to understand what happened to his cousin. And what do you say, right? And I'm a good parent, and I try hard, but and I know truth is age appropriate. And I lied to him, and I said he didn't feel anything. One second he was asleep, and the next second he was with God. And you could talk to him every time, and sometimes he'll even answer you. But that's just me thinking on the fly. And I thank God that that thought came through my head. And ultimately, he's obviously learned the truth. But what do you do as a parent in those situations? And so hopefully this is something that, you know, people that are searching will find and hopefully ease their pain. And not only ease their pain, create joy in their life as throughout their future, and this is what post-traumatic winning is, that when somebody is in pain and somebody is suffering and they don't know what to do with this thing that they can't forget, that you can ease their pain and then show them these things and saying, now if you'll do this for somebody else and you'll do this for the rest of your life, you can overwhelm your traumatic experiences with joyful ones as you change people's lives. And in that way, you can not only live a good life, you'll live a great life. And so, yeah. How about that for a little light?
Wow, yeah, oh, man.
How about that?
I'm speechless because I'm a great admirer of what you're doing. But that is definitely that is such a poignant concept. You've got it now you've talked about it, especially on air. You've got to do it, man.
Oh no, I mean I love the idea, and I'm gonna have my daughters help me with it, and so hopefully by the end of the year. But I will read your book so I can shit on it.
Thanks, man.
The same thing with Mike Etor's book, and then I'll send you mine, and you can try to shit on my book. But I mean, it is inspiring. And, you know, and Andy, the other part of this is you've gone down that trail. I mean, you lost a daughter, right? You have your own, you know, experiences deployed in multiple combat deployments. And so I know you get it. And so, so that makes this all the more, meaningful and fun. So anyway.
I don't mean to elongate this, but I talk about that in the book, and this isn't me plugging the book. I'm just saying, but you know, the first two times I wrote that, you know, the first two kind of editions, I just couldn't bring myself to talk about grief and loss, and some of the, frankly, some of the just the post combat stress, you know, that pertained to some of the things that we all saw, you know, not necessarily fear, but just pertaining to some of the shocking things that we all saw, and then had to subsequent deal with. So I didn't mention that at all. And then I spoke to a guy named Ben Connival. Some of you may know.
Ben and I served together in 2006 in Fallujah.
No kidding.
Yeah, he's an awesome guy.
He's at Rand now. Yeah. And by the way, he got a PhD, but after he left the Marine Corps, super but, smart.
Hey,
super,
by, yeah. By the way, he's a smart guy.
Yeah, he is. So I got him to read, you know, my book, and he said, hey, man, you need to dig a little deeper here. And if you're going to write about yourself, you got to be honest about every aspect of it.
When I do post-traumatic winning, right, one of the things I've learned is that, you know, you can stand up as a leader of an organization and say, hey, this is really important and we've got to talk about it. And if you do that, Marines are going to look at you and say, whatever, fucking dude. Right? We hear that all the time. But if you stand up and do what you should do, which is to say, let me tell you about me. And you would tell the story about your life and then your daughter. Because the bottom line is that Marines don't think, let's just suppose you were a colonel doing this. Marines don't believe you struggle with what they struggle with. They don't believe that. And so yeah. when Dave Furness stands up about talking about the day he found out that his daughter, who was 4 years old at the time, was mentally retarded, when A.J. Pasagian, who's a brigadier general, talks about having a pistol put in his mouth when he was 15, working at an ice cream stand on the eve of Thanksgiving, right, back in Queens. And when General Mullen talks about his 11-year-old brother drowning when he was a lieutenant in Okinawa and that phone call and coming back for his funeral. When you watch that and you see the power of that, you know, and then you see the way people will approach people that they would have never approached before, you know that it's the only way. And
yeah.
Conrable gave you great advice, because without that, it's just the bullshit boilerplate that everybody talks about. And I will say this about me and doing post-traumatic winning. I did not share stuff that I share now when I started, like you. I gave a sanitized version that I was comfortable with. Now, I'll go places that I didn't. I had one of my younger sisters froze to death as a result of alcoholism and cold temperatures in Indianapolis. I didn't talk about that at first. I didn't talk about the fact that I don't talk to my dad. You know, but as I've done it, I understand the importance of being honest. And when you're honest yeah. with other people, you give them permission to be honest with you. And so it's really important. And I knew Conrable was smart. I didn't think he was that smart, though.
No, he's a terrific guy.
How do you know Ben?
I was, we crossed paths, but it's like, I don't think we've ever actually met. And then I was referred to him by a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Worth Parker, who's a Marsoc guy, but also a great intellectual. Worth won't worry about me calling him that, but he really is. And he said, hey, you need to get hold of this guy, Ben Conrable. And I had heard of him, and I read some of his stuff. He's a great writer. Okay. But, you know, it was tremendous advice. And, Mac, you're doing the Lord's work, man. I've got tremendous admiration for you. And anytime you want to bring me back on your show.
Well, we need to do your book. So have you sent it to me?
I have. You know what? I'm lying. It's in my car. I'm about to send it.
Well, no shit. I was like, I haven't seen it.
I'll send it.
You're a fucking liar, Andy. What the fuck?
I'll send you a PDF version too, but the hard copy.
Don't send me that. I need a hard copy that I can mark up where I can put like writing in the margin going, this is stupid. Like, who told you this, man? Like, what?
Yeah, by all means. If you like it.
No. If I hate it, you're coming on. I'm going to pay for it, man. Trust me.
I'll bore all your listeners talking about it.
What's the title of it?
It's called When the Tempest Gathers.
Ah, ooh, that's kind of English. Yeah. It sounds like something Churchill would fucking author.
Yeah, not quite, actually. It's an American poet, Josiah Holland.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, it does sound Churchillian.
Doesn't it? Well, there you go. You're in good company then, because as he said, I know history will be kind to me because I will write it. That is one of his best lines ever.
There's many, many quotes.
Yeah. Right, and he did.
Well, you know, he also said something apropos to our discussion today. He said, the United States can always be relied on to do the right thing after exhausting every other alternative.
That's true, right? And what was his other? Democracy is, right, is the best form of government, right? There's a similar quote to that. I can't remember it anyway. All right. First of all, happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, Mac. All the best to you. Take care.
There you have it. Andrew Milburn, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Let me just tell you, I know it's Thanksgiving, but All Marine Radio is going to be great this week. Mike Marletto, again, the commanding officer of the 11th Marine Regiment and the fire support coordinator for the 1st Marine Division during the march up, is going to join us. Mike, not only all of that, but a great, great, great leader in his own right. So he is the, like, darling of all the arty dudes I know. I was texting them when we were doing the interview yesterday saying, hey, man, I'm talking to Mike Marletto. Eat it, bro. They were pissed. What? You're talking to St. Marletto? I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm a grunt, and I'm talking to him. On your knees, Mac. You do not rate to talk to St. Marletto. I'm like, really, dudes? Really? We're going to go there? that'll do it on a Monday. Yeah, no kidding, man. And then Lynch and Kenny on Wednesday. I don't know if the chef's going to make an appearance, which is bumming him out. He hopes to if he feels better. So, we shall see. But yeah, Mike Marletto tomorrow. And I'll tell you what, it's an awesome interview. Don't miss it. If you weren't listening earlier, Mike Marletto was in Beirut the day that the barracks was blown up. He was living in the barracks, in that building. He was asked to go do something the previous night, didn't finish it till late, and so couldn't get back. That's the only reason he survived. Yeah, his story's an amazing story, but and he's a great guy, and he's become a great friend of mine. So check it out. Say a prayer for the SEAL community, man. It's a community in that's fighting for its own soul. And pray that it turns out well. Because the things that are happening are not in the best interest of the proud tradition that is the United States Naval Special Warfare Group that you all know as SEALs. So keep an eye on what happens to Admiral Greene. But what the President of the United States has done, as you heard Andy talking about, and Andy does nothing but tell the truth. You know, that's what I love about the guy. You know, and he's a MARSOC guy, former commanding officer of Marine Raiders, right? Our MARSOC organization. And so when you hear him tell those stories, you know, those are painful to tell. But you know what? If you won't honor the truth, if you won't go there, then, I mean, we don't need more politicians, especially inside the DOD. With that said, have a great day on a Monday before Thanksgiving. All Marine Radio is over and...